Hello, I'm Richard Aidy. This is The Money. Today, something big is on its way. Amazon, the company that started by selling books, is now much, much more than a bookseller. John McDooling is an associate editor at the Australian Financial Review.
There's constant rumours about them scoping out warehouse space in this country. A lot of the analysts in the investment banking community have predicted quite confidently that they will launch something in Australia this year in terms of their e-commerce operations. They've obviously had an online bookselling presence for a number of years here. Their web services business has been here for a long time and has a lot of big corporate customers. And the most recent thing, I guess, is that they did launch their streaming video operation service in Australia quite recently, as they did in many other countries. But what that does is it gives them a direct billing relationship with thousands of consumers in Australia, which they could later turn into an e-commerce relationship.
The consensus seems to be that Amazon will start Australian operations in September. This is more than having a .com.au website, as it does now. It means a physical presence with warehouses, logistics, staff. A survey by Nielsen out earlier this week shows Australians are interested in being customers. Brad Stone wrote a book on Amazon, The Everything Store. So should Australian retailers be concerned?
You know, I think very concerned. I think it should provoke a real self-examination and the question, you know, what do you offer your customers in terms of experience, in terms of price? How strong is your relationship with them? And can you be supplanted? You know, if we look here in North America, the companies that have survived the Amazon onslaught, I don't know if you're familiar with the clothing retailer Nordstrom, you know, but you walk into a Nordstrom here and, you know, you get great customer service, the return policy is generous, you've got someone who's kind of your personal shopper, and it's known for that. And that's something that e-commerce in general and Amazon in particular can't replicate.
How well prepared are Australian retailers for Amazon's arrival?
People have described Australia as an oligopoly economy. In every sort of market segment in this country, there's, you know, one or two big players. And if you think about physical retail, before the internet, it wasn't easy to sell stuff to people at scale. You had to build a physical network of stores around the country and supply chains and that type of thing. And it meant, you know, we only had a couple of players in that market and they enjoyed some of the biggest profit margins in the world. And now you've got a company with a different model, largely does not have physical stores, has, you know, very advanced supply chains and is entirely focused on keeping prices low rather than maximizing its short-term profits. That's a pretty formidable competitor, and that's not something that I don't think Australian retail CEOs will be looking forward to competing against.
The problem that Amazon poses is not as simple as just being cheaper.
To begin with, there is pretty much everything under the sun because Amazon is not just a retailer where it sells items itself, but it's a marketplace where any other seller can come to the site and list their wares. You know, so to begin with, you know, I would say selection is pretty unlimited. You know, the marketplace accounts for about half of all of Amazon's retail sales. But then you step away from retail altogether and you've got very untraditional products like computer instances. And this is all via their AWS unit, which, you know, did about $3 billion in sales just last quarter. And so, you know, this is the division that has kind of revolutionized enterprise computing. And so in that respect, the Everything Store is, you know, is not just products, but it's digital services as well. And then we can talk about groceries, which is a major Amazon initiative. Apparel, you know, it's a major drive into clothes. And they're even exploring very recently in the U.S. physical retail, so actual Amazon stores. So this is a company that's operating on a lot of different dimensions.
Jeff Bezos founded Amazon in 1994. Their website went live in 1995. And Elizabeth Maitland from the University of New South Wales says he's always planned for the long term.
What Bezos seems to have known from the beginning is that, in fact, it's a scale game. And that to build scale takes time. So you've got to build scale in terms of warehouses, in terms of that customer base that then supports the algorithms and how they promote products to you, to build the logistics network, to build the brand. And over time, they've got those three core businesses: Amazon Marketplace, which the books are now just part of, Amazon Web Services, which comes off all the servers and the computing grunt that they built to then run that digital business, and Amazon Prime, which is their subscription business. So you buy a subscription and you can go onto them and get free delivery and free streaming and all sorts of products sent to you.
And though at first this seems like a slightly odd combination, it fits together rather well.
There's this concept within Amazon called the flywheel, or it's also called the virtuous cycle, where kind of every piece of the business is supposed to work with and drive another piece of the business. So if you think about just the retail part of the business, you know, when you lower prices on Amazon, you know, you're going to get more customer shopping there. And then you're going to draw more suppliers out to list their items on the Amazon website in its marketplace. And so more items is more competition and leads back in turn to lower prices. So there's lots of these different flywheels around the business, and they think quite strategically. Unlike, say, a Google that is quite happy to go off into the corner and do something like develop driverless cars, at Amazon you tend to see how strategically every piece fits together. And at the center of it all, as usual, is something called Amazon Prime, this $99 a year in the U.S. Shipping service, you know, where people just tend to buy more if they're part of it. And so Amazon does a lot of things that is meant to drive the number of people that sign up for Prime.
If you know the music, it's because you've seen Transparent, the critically acclaimed TV show about a transgender woman made by Amazon Studios. Amazon Studios content is a key component of Amazon Prime.
Amazon Prime is their subscription service, and for a fee at the moment, I think it's $99 a year in the US, you can get next day delivery or expedited delivery for almost anything on their platform, which again can be electronics, which can be household goods, which can be groceries. And in the US, again, thrown in with that offer, they include for free their streaming TV product, which competes directly with Netflix, which has a lot of their own original shows on it. And it's a pretty compelling proposition for consumers. And, you know, it's pretty hard for other people to compete with.
For Amazon, the real advantage of Prime is that Prime subscribers spend more.
That's right. I mean, there's this faintly irrational human impulse to maximize the benefit of a club you've already joined. And so when you pay that $99 in the US, it may be that the prices on Amazon aren't as good. Maybe you can get a better deal at a local grocery store or another chain like a Costco. But, you know, you know that you've got the Prime membership, and so it's kind of the first stop. You know, you just see it. I'm a Prime member in the U.S., and I see it in my own history of shopping on Amazon. Every year, I've spent more. And, you know, and so we see Amazon rolling out all these devices, these tools to get people to basically remove barriers between Prime members and shopping. For example, you know, the Alexa, this voice-activated device that can sit in your home. You know, if you're a Prime member, you can just say, order toilet paper, and it will put that on your Amazon purchase list, and it shows up 2 days later. So, yeah, Prime is kind of an accelerant for commerce on the site.
Not only that, Elizabeth Maitland believes Prime gives Amazon another advantage.
I think it will also be incredibly important to overcoming the costs of that last mile. One of the big problems for Amazon is that logistics and packaging is still a big chunk of their cost base, and that's what erodes margins in the e-commerce business. And in countries like Australia, that last mile, getting it from the fulfillment center or the warehouse to your home, is actually very expensive. If you have your customers buying more in each transaction, so each time something gets sent out to you, there's actually going to be more product there, it's higher value, then again, that will lower those costs of packaging, it will lower the costs of shipping and make their overall offering that much more valuable and that much more higher margin. So my guess is it'll be quite important.
This is The Money on RN, the ABC Radio app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Aidy. Today, we're looking at Amazon, one of the biggest, most successful companies in the world, which is coming to Australia. Amazon says it's focused on the customer. But aren't all businesses?
You know, there are a lot of companies which balance different constituencies, right? There's the customer, but maybe they're also their suppliers. You know, they want to be good partners. And there's their employees, right? They want people to be happy coming to work. And there are the neighborhoods where they operate, right? They want to be good corporate citizens. And Amazon's difference is that when we say that they're customer focus. It's like a maniacal focus. There's no illusion as to how they list these different partners, right? It's about serving the customer, getting them the right price, pulling as many unnecessary costs out of your business as possible so you can drive benefit to the customer. And, you know, it turns out that, you know, that creates a harsh work environment. It means Amazon can come into towns and not be a great corporate citizen. You know, in the early years, it didn't pay sales tax in the United States. And it's a very tough company to do business with. They tend to put margin pressure on their suppliers. So when we say Amazon's customer focused, you know, it means it's great to kind of sign up and be an Amazon customer. And we find in all sorts of ways to do business with them, to work for them, to have them come into your neighborhood. This is where people start to get uncomfortable. And that is why Amazon is different.
The company's also different in another way. Elizabeth Maitland.
Really, what they are is a central information platform. They're one of a handful of companies that collects data about customers and then looks at really different ways for using that data. So the other players are Google, Facebook, Apple, for example. All of them are big data collectors. They know enormous amounts about you. They know what you search for. They know ultimately what you might be looking to buy. They know enormous amounts of things about what's going on in your daily life. But unlike Facebook and unlike Google, what Amazon really can do is fulfill. So they not only provide you the platform to go and look for things, they can then get that product to you, whether it's a digital product in terms of, you know, streaming content or an electronic book. They can also get a physical product to you. And that's something neither Facebook nor Google, who are also big central information platforms, both in processing grunt and computing grunt and all the algorithms that run behind it to find out about customers. Amazon fulfills. And so in that sense, it's a truly fascinating company. It wants to close the loop completely.
Simon Wardley is with the IT research and advisory firm Leading Edge Forum. He says a big part of Amazon's success comes from the fact that it's quite unlike the companies it's competing with.
Typically, most organizations have little to no understanding of the competitive landscape they're operating in. Most organizations typically have siloed structures, poor communication issues, lots of duplication. But this is okay because they're competing against others who are operating in the same way. So the old saying, it's okay to suck in business as long as everybody else does, is basically where they're at. The problem they have is Amazon is very, well, it certainly appears to be very good at identifying areas of large margin, industrializing those often utility services or highly commoditized components, exposing those to others, often by providing things like a public API or some sort of two-factor platform play, allowing others to build on top of that, and then exploiting what we call metadata or consumption data to identify new patterns. And so the problem that most corporations have is they are fighting a very different beast with Amazon compared to the sort of companies they've fought in the past. Amazon is very cell-based structured, they're very fast-moving, they've got an incredible focus on the actual users, whereas most organizations don't.
Amazon likes to see itself as an inventor, but Simon Wardley says its real strength is improving something that's already there.
They are rarely the first mover. You often get other companies have moved into a space, and they are very good at the process of industrializing it. And in fact, they have an internal process called the press release process. So before somebody starts a project in Amazon, you have to write the press release. And that's a wonderful way of forcing an organization to industrialize pre-existing acts rather than genuinely creating some novel and new innovation. So if you look at what Amazon's done, cloud computing, you know, computing existed well before they started to provide it as utility services. As you're right, booksellers existed well before Amazon started to industrialize that process. Pretty much every single activity you can think Amazon does existed before Amazon got into the game.
Brad Stone says Amazon bristles at this kind of observation.
They would point to things like the Echo, which is this voice-powered device that uses the Alexa algorithm, you know, the Kindle, which is the kind of book industry changing e-reader, you know, Amazon Web Services, massively influential on the enterprise computing industry, really started with Amazon and has been avidly copied by the likes of Google and Microsoft. And then in e-commerce in general, you know, the first market Amazon did get into, you know, they would lay claim to inventions like one-click ordering and Prime two-day shipping. You know, we can call some of those things processes and kind of question whether they were true inventions. And in some cases, like the Kindle, there were other companies that got there first. But Amazon does tend to bring a lot of weapons to the invention process. And, you know, one of them is their ability to drive costs out of the system and offering things at low prices. You know, the Echo was certainly not the first voice activated device, but, you know, they sold a couple million of them. So I don't know. I think there is a lot of inventiveness at Amazon. Coupled with aggression, it's a pretty formidable company.
Alexa, tell me about the Amazon Echo.
Amazon Echo is a device designed around your voice that can provide information, music, news, weather, and more.
Okay, cool. Alexa, how many teaspoons in a tablespoon?
One tablespoon equals...
On the money today, Amazon, the e-commerce giant coming Australia's way. So far, you've heard it's relentlessly focused on the customer, that it collects and uses huge amounts of data, and that it's very good at industrializing existing processes. There's something else.
So most companies try to maximize their profits or their bottom line. Amazon doesn't do that. Jeff Bezos talks about maximizing a metric, I think it's net operating cash flow per share. They focus on growing their revenues, and they reinvest all their sort of cash flows into keeping prices low and to building out this distribution network across the US and across the world in order to get stuff to you as quickly as possible. That is a really different model. In Australia, we're used to our companies. People want to know how much profit are you making, what kind of dividends are you paying. In the US, investors are more than happy with Amazon's different approach because they can see that in the future, if they continue to grow the way they are growing, eventually they'll be so dominant.
Jeff Bezos has taken this approach from day one.
If you go back to where he started, those initial original investors gave him time. They gave an enormous amount of time to build that scale business against Barnes & Noble. It took up until about 2005 for Amazon to be outselling Barnes & Noble. And that was a long time after they started. And the investors still aren't getting a massive return, it's believed, on that particular part of the business. So e-commerce has very low margins, 2 to 3%. But it formed the basis for the other businesses that he has. And so they've finally broken out how much Amazon Web Services contributes and how rapidly that's growing. And the margins there are huge. They're much, much bigger. And I guess through that process, he's built in that original investor community. And then once they've gone onto the stock exchanges in the broader investment community, a confidence that he knows what he's doing.
Brad Stone says Bezos is the company's biggest asset.
They have in their founder and CEO an executive who can think circles around most other people in business. I mean, he's a true, you know, natural born genius, kind of fueled with a desire to create something sustainable. And not just in business, but he's also developing on the side a space company. So his abilities and skills are quite impressive. And I think certain things that Amazon has done have really sprung right from his mind. You know, the Echo Speaker, the Kindle, Amazon Web Services. And so, you know, he's really operating on the same wavelength as a Steve Jobs at Apple, really, or a Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook. And, you know, to have a founder who thinks so carefully about the rules of business and has investors who back him wholeheartedly. I mean, that's another piece that Amazon can and has at times lost a lot of money and investors stay with him. He is not susceptible to the same kind of short-term thinking pressures as other leaders. So his genius and the pact that he has with investors is really Amazon's special sauce.
4 years ago, we started to wonder, what would shopping look like if you could walk into a store, grab what you want, and just go? What if we could weave the most advanced machine learning, computer vision, and AI into the very fabric of a store so you never have to wait in line? No lines.
The first of these stores is in Seattle. At the moment, it's still being tested, but it's expected to open to the public soon. And it's another way that Amazon's shaping consumers.
What it's doing is changing the way we think about our needs being met. So the instant gratification that in certain US cities, you can have products delivered to you within an hour. In Seattle, they're experimenting with grocery outlets where you order online, then you drive up to somewhere that's on your way home. You park your car, Amazon employees come out with the groceries that you've just ordered. So you don't have to walk through a supermarket yourself. You've done it online, they bring it to you, you go home. And I guess in that sense, that ability for our needs to be met quickly, easily, both drives more consumption, but changes our willingness to tolerate companies that can't get things to us quickly or can't anticipate our needs.
So Elizabeth, if you're an Australian retailer, how would you be feeling?
It would depend on what kind of retailer I was. If I was one of the big incumbents who uses my scale not to deliver to Australian customers innovation in my product, but in fact to just increase my margin, I would be worried because that's exactly the type of business that Amazon disrupts. If I was a small independent retailer, I may not be worried because in fact that's the type of retailer that Amazon actually in fact allows to flourish. Because what they're delivering to their customers is something about the relationship between them and the customer, that face-to-face interaction.
Okay, but which parts of retailing are thought to be the most vulnerable? John McDooling.
The analysts seem to think that it's the electronics retailers, people like JB Hi-Fi and Harvey Norman. They sell a lot of electronics and so does Amazon, and Amazon tends to be cheaper than everyone else in the market, so they could be at risk. The big question is whether or not they get into the grocery game in Australia or not. We have seen, you know, traditionally the duopoly of Coles and Woolworths facing pressure from Aldi lately, and you know, another entrant like Amazon would be a very interesting proposition if that happened. We just don't know at this stage whether that will happen or not. It is a pretty new business for them in the US, that fresh food and groceries. So we'll just have to wait and see.
That Nielsen survey I mentioned earlier says electronics is the category Australians are most interested in buying. Books are second, then clothes. That's bad news for Australian fashion retailers. They're already under pressure from fast fashion brands like H&M, Zara and Topshop.
These large fast fashion manufacturers are collecting information constantly around the world about which colour groupings sell, which designs sell. And they have the manufacturing supply chains that allow them to very quickly adapt their product. Our retailers, even if you look at what's gone on with some of our big department stores that have moved into private label product, is that they work on much longer supply chain cycles. And so from design to sale to working out it doesn't have traction, it's a long period of time. And they aren't set up to cope with these big companies that have deep pockets and probably aren't making particularly good margins in Australia at the moment, but they're willing to do it as they build brand loyalty, as they build up customer awareness, and as they build up knowledge of the Australian customer. You know, what do we respond to? Is it identical to a British customer or an American customer? No. Our seasonal cycles are going to be slightly different. But they have all those sales around the world to wear that investment against. But they also have all the knowledge of what's going on in different markets in terms of design, in terms of fashion, in terms of preference, in terms of who responds to which YouTube blogger, etc., and get that product into Australia relatively quickly.
And something else, retailing won't be the only sector of the economy affected by Amazon.
I think the really interesting question from Amazon's entry to Australia and its implication for Australian companies is what it will do for Australian manufacturers. By giving them an alternative platform for getting their product at scale out to Australian consumers, but also in terms of giving them the ability to get their product out of Australia and into Amazon's global logistics and distribution network. So through Marketplace, they can then access much, much broader networks. So I think while our big retailers are certainly in for a shock, and it is going to be challenging for them to think about how do you respond and how do you use your existing bricks and mortar networks and your existing logistics operations that bring product into those stores to then innovate and maintain customer loyalty, I think for other players in Australia, this is actually a really interesting opportunity.
But Amazon may not have things all its own way. The company's under some pressure at home.
In terms of the cultural things, I think that is a very significant issue facing the company in the US at an interesting time in the US business climate at the moment and also the way technology companies are perceived. They've been criticized heavily for the grueling conditions in their warehouses. You know, the corporate culture there is said to be pretty tough and pretty hardworking. And, you know, Australia, we have stricter protections around things like that. And we have a different attitude to the US on issues surrounding, you know, workplace laws and, you know, overtime pay and that type of thing. How important that is to their model in Australia in terms of keeping prices low remains to be seen, because they can also move money around the world in order to compete strongly in new markets that they enter. So that really remains to be seen. But I definitely think, you know, the company has faced a pretty significant backlash in the US for the way that it treats its workers. And it's definitely something that they'll have to deal with.
So what did you do at work today? Chances are good that on this Cyber Monday, there was some point, click, and buy going on. A record-breaking $1.5 billion worth of merchandise is expected to have been ordered online today. And no one ships more orders than Amazon. It's a company known for its competitiveness and its secrecy. But
Amazon is coming. It looks like it will be good for consumers and maybe manufacturers. But if you're a big retailer like Harvey Norman or JB Hi-Fi, what can you do?
People often say, well, we've got to out-innovate them. If you look at somebody like Blockbuster or Kodak, we'll take Blockbuster. If you look at having a website, Blockbuster was first with a website, but ahead of somebody like Netflix. It was doing video ordering online and trials for video streaming before its competitors as well. And it's like Kodak with the first major player in with digital still cameras and online photo service. But the problem is they had all had inertia. And that inertia was created by past success and pre-existing business models. So in the case of Blockbuster, it was late fees for video rentals. So despite the fact that it was pretty much out-innovating most people, it had internal inertia and struggles caused by its own past success. So one of the biggest issues faced by any company when you get one of these new entrants, new players coming in, particularly if they're focused on industrializing a pre-existing sort of market, which basically means they're turning your margin into their opportunity, is you'll tend to dismiss it. You'll deny it's going to happen. You're going to say, well, we've got plenty of time, etc. And most of that will come from a poor understanding of the landscape, and secondly, your own inertia, your own past success. And it can be reinforced by internal rewards, bonus structures, etc. So what's my advice for them? Adapt and adapt quickly.
Retail King Jerry Harvey is talking tough about Amazon, but he and others will have limited options.
You're probably not going to beat Amazon on price. You're never going to beat Amazon or the internet in selection because, you know, you can list everything for sale on the internet. You might get them on convenience because it still does take 2 days or, you know, maybe a day for something to appear on your doorstep. So I think, you know, all retailers need to think, okay, can I be beat? And if so, how do I get better? Because believe me, Amazon is coming for your business, so you should get ready.
Right. So what does the retail landscape look like in, say, 5 years? Elizabeth Maitland.
Our big grocery retailers are big players. They have the assets to meet the competition. I certainly think they'll have a big impact outside the grocery sector in terms of being able to move into electronic products, being able to go into things that we're already used to looking at online and thinking, oh, I just get it delivered. I think it will massively shake up retailing in Australia, and all for the better. I think what will be interesting is, do Australian customers get smart and not hand over their information for free? We're very good at giving these retailers our information, which they then data mine for us. Well, maybe we'll get smarter at saying, if you want my data, if you want my purchasing habits, I want you to offer me more value in what you do. So for customers, I suspect there's going to be much better returns to this type of retailing.
Thanks to Associate Professor Elizabeth Maitland from the University of New South Wales and Brad Stone, author of The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon. You also heard from John McDooling, who's at the Australian Financial Review, and Simon Wardley from Leading Edge Forum. You can hear more about the rapidly shifting retail scene with Geraldine Doogue on Saturday Extra here on RN. If you're listening to this as a podcast, take a moment to rate and review the show. It helps other people find it. The Money's produced by Kate Piercy. Our sound engineer is Jennifer Parsonage. And I'm Richard Ady. We're buying and selling.